Sure, thank you. It's wonderful to be here. So I head the behavioural insight team, the Nudge Unit, but actually also I have done time and lots of other things. So I was trying to think, must have been involved in at least three spending review exercises on the R&D numbers. I mean, let's face it, partly we're at the 2.4, as Patrick said, because it's an average, it seemed a modest thing, and Jeremy Hayward said, goodness sake, we should at least try and do that. I've got three kind of quick sort of remarks. One is, are there some kind of smaller seeming moves which we could do around Nudge, as you might call them, to encourage more firms, particularly to do more R&D? The second thing, some kind of slightly broader questions, which pick up on a lot of Patrick's remarks. And then I've got a third bucket, which are like, crazy. I have to do a bit of that, which do the wider ecosystem. So on the first thing, yeah, I mean, some of it which you already touched on, I won't go into more detail, around some things about the incentives of CEOs, et cetera. We've certainly peered into that quite a lot. So maybe I won't repeat that. But another area we've been looking at quite a lot is, you know, as Patrick says, R&D tax credits got a pretty respectable evidence base that they do increase activity somewhat, you know, better than most evidence base for most taxes probably in many areas. But the question still is there, well, could you increase their effectiveness? So one thing we've certainly been looking at, for example, is that, you know, as we turn to HMRC and others to say, well, what can you do to drive up the uptake on R&D? This very rapidly inside government turns into, what can you do to increase the number of firms who claim their R&D tax credit? Which actually isn't what we're trying to do primarily, right? We want firms to actually increase their R&D activity. So there are some quite interesting questions, we think, and possibilities around sort of shaping the R&D sort of tax credit activity, encouragement. So, I mean, just simple examples would be, certainly for many small firms, they hesitate to do it because they're not sure if they will get the money afterwards. So psychologists are obsessed about, you know, discounting. We think people discount much more than a financial model, if human beings do. So if you're kind of thinking, shall I do this R&D activity? Well, I might or might not get some of that R&D tax credit back. So the uncertainty is very problematic. So more forward guidance by HMRC to say early on, yeah, actually, advanced assurance is sometimes called. So if you do the following thing, you are going to get your money back afterwards. It's a really key kind of practical point. We also think a lot, and partly Richard Thaler got the Nobel Prize for his work on mental accounting. So what can you do to encourage firms to think about that when they get the money back also, to put it straight into R&D activity? So we think, in short, there are quite a few things where, without spending any more money, we could adjust the way that we handle our engagement with firms around R&D tax credit to get them to actually more R&D. So that's cheap and cheerful and really worth doing. Kind of broader set of questions, second bucket really is to do with, again, Patrick picked up on some of these things. Do you think it's interesting how people, in fact, one of the presentations earlier, had it almost interchangeably with science, which looks pretty odd given Patrick's graph on we're nearly 80% services. I mean, Amazon is a well-rehearsed one about, you know, what's it doing, and in fact, interesting arguments about Amazon with US regulators, is that R&D? And of course, one of their key points is we can't separate R&D from how we work as a business because the whole thing is about experimentation. That's in stark contrast, you know, someone in the city said, well, Amazon, God, even more now, you know, spends more on R&D than the entire city of London. Like, what is that? What do we think? Why can't services in the UK do more, and what would that look and feel like? But even close to our own backyard, so government, if you look at what is government expenditure, which is quite substantial. And if we apply the 2.4% to that, it's a hell of a lot more than we spend now, even in Patrick's graph, right? Do we really think that it's not possible to improve and innovate around educational practice, let alone health or criminal justice or all these other areas, even design of welfare? Why not? Why do we not think that's subject to the same kind of innovation funds and activity where we could figure out better ways of doing these things? So that means otherwise we've got 40% of our economy we're not even really looking at to say, well, what would R&D and innovations occur? Anyone who lives in it surely thinks, you know, we have massive legacy activities and programs where we aren't really trying out sort of new variations on what might be possible, which would give us leaps. Every reason to think, I mean, in my own backyard, we try and do some of it, you know, but we could be so much more ambitious, I think, in that space. And again, you might look to what the Canadians have done and Trudeau's instruction to departments, which is that basically every department should spend a certain proportion of its activity on what we would call R&D. So I think we could be much bolder. So finally, what's my last bucket? A few things. So one of the things about this whole R&D question, which has been rehearsed by a couple of the speakers, is that it's never just the R&D activity itself. Certainly we don't do very much of the D, you might say, it's more of the R. But it's about, it sits in a context. And even if you go back to the OECD analysis about why is it that it drives the growth in the way it does, you know, 95% of research not done in the UK, a lot of what's happening is actually it just drives up your absorptive capacity to use the research from elsewhere. So it's actually, even the core work seems to be translational. So what areas would you might look at? I mean, for us, we think one of the key issues is around market structure and activity. So there's a wider set of questions about incentives, which is how innovative are our consumers and purchasers in government and more generally? So if a firm does come up with a neat innovation, does it get adopted rapidly or does it not? And we think there are major market failures around adoption of technology and its purchasing. So within government, various attempts to do SBRI, but in general, you know, if you say, what's the equivalent of which magazine, which directs companies towards saying, here's a really cool new innovation, you might want to try out this new bit of kit, versus actually the underlying incentive is, you know what, we'll wait until this software has been around for a few years and then maybe we'll try it out once it's all settled down. So you really want your early adopters and you want to actively catalyze that process. Otherwise, who will pick it up? So kind of procurement type issues. Even on the skills and so on, you know, what are the other kinds of things that VC activities do? I'll call it from mine from number 10. Paul Kirby's doing some stuff on Zinc, which is actually trying to run programs which take cohorts of people who might have gone into a PhD and encourage them to actually be kind of entrepreneurial and really do the D bit much more extensively. I think we go further. And the last bit I'll just put down at least. So we've done some work over the time. We talk a lot about the valley of death in relation to, you know, the obvious R&D, the universities, etc. We think there's an even bigger valley of death in an area which is sometimes known as user-generated innovation. So there's an estimate that about 6%, actually I think it was picked up in some Nestor work a few years ago, of the population are serial inventors and adapters. They just keep fiddling with stuff. They sometimes do it in a workplace, sometimes at home. And that there are some very famous examples, you know, the mountain bike, you know, was an example, the baby jogger, disposable nappies. They weren't developed by companies, they were developed by an individual who had a cool idea. And what's the valley of death in that area is much, much more severe. This stuff really doesn't diffuse. And so I think it's one of those examples, there are a few of them, where there's untapped sources of innovation and activity, which we should apply the same rigor and thought to say, what's the value of that? Do we measure it? And what's the translational activity which gets those kinds of things to spread across the economy? So I end up, I guess, pretty upbeat. I think it's 2.4%, great, go for it. Let's be bolder, but also let's be bolder and more imaginative about the range of what that could mean.